Hello and welcome to Ukraine Calling, your weekly review of what's been happening in Ukraine with a focus on a main issue. I'm Marta Dechork for Hromadske Radio, and here's a look at some of the stories that caught my attention.
The Obama administration striking back against Russia Thursday for interfering in the 2016 U.S. election, expelling 35 Russian diplomats from the country, closing two Russian compounds in New York and Maryland, and imposing strict new sanctions against Russian intelligence officials and agencies.
За минулу добу внаслідок бойових дій жоден український військовослужбовець не загинув і не був поранений.
אני רוצה להרגיע אתכם. ההחלטה שהתקבלה אתמול באום היא מעוותת, היא מבישה. אבל אנחנו נתגבר עליה.
Це дуже важливий крок від комуністичного минулого, який ми нарешті зробили вперше.
As another year comes to an end, many people are thinking about how to celebrate. But war continues in Ukraine's Donbas. Some soldiers are facing their third New Year's Eve on the front. Over the past week, two soldiers were killed, 10 were wounded. A report came out a few days before the year's end stating that in 2016, a total of 211 soldiers had been killed and 256 civilians. Ukraine's broadcast regulator has been busy in recent months. The National Council for TV and Radio Broadcasting has been reviewing and issuing new licenses. Hromadske Radio won tenders to broadcast on two FM frequencies in the Odessa region in a recent competition. Just as the year was coming to an end, one of the country's main commercial TV channels, OnePlus1, began to fear that its license may not be renewed. On December the 28th, the channel's executive wrote an open letter to President Poroshenko, the Prime Minister, and the Parliamentary Speaker, asking for the license renewal. It seems the issue is about transparency of ownership. The regulator is requiring the channel to submit documents which clearly indicate who the owner is. Reportedly, the channel is owned by Igor Kolomoisky. Ukraine Calling listeners may remember we reported that he used to own the country's largest private bank, Privatbank, until it was nationalized last week. We'll have a feature interview about Ukraine's media with Hromadske Radio CEO Andriy Kulikov later in the show. Ukraine now has a state budget for 2017. Parliament approved the document, and President Poroshenko signed it into law on Monday, December the 26th. The minimum wage has been doubled. The defense sector will receive 5.2% of the GDP, and major infrastructure spending is planned, particularly in the roads sector. New measures were introduced aimed at improving the tax administration. These include VAT reimbursement and online interface for taxpayers. According to government sources, revenue collection improved during 2016. In November, the state treasury reported a 14.8 billion Ukrainian hryvnia surplus. That's about 550 million US dollars. President Poroshenko said that local budgets have increased, in some cases five to sixfold. This is after decentralization reforms were introduced 3 years ago. With this budget, Ukraine is optimistic that it will receive the next tranche of the IMF loan. Its board of directors meets again at the end of January of 2017. Cybersecurity was the hot topic at Ukraine's National Security and Defense Council year-end meeting on Thursday. That same day, the United States expelled 35 Russian diplomats and announced new sanctions against Russia for cyber attacks that had interfered with their presidential election. Ukraine was discussing the 6,500 cyber attacks it had detected against itself. The Ukrainian Security Council revealed that on December the 6th, these attacks had put the State Treasury and the Ministry of Finance out of action for a while. Previous attacks had targeted energy sector objects, nuclear power stations, Boryspil Airport, as well as industrial objects, transportation and communications infrastructure, particularly in the Donetsk and Luhansk regions. President Poroshenko said, "We are dealing with a global security challenge of Russia to the entire Euro-Atlantic community." He called for international interagency cooperation. Ukraine may have valuable experience to share. Tensions appeared between Ukraine and Israel this week. The two countries have enjoyed diplomatic relations since 1991, when Ukraine became independent. In 2011, Israel lifted visa restrictions for Ukrainians. But when Ukraine voted in favor of a UN resolution condemning Israeli settlements in the West Bank, Israel canceled Ukraine's prime minister's visit. It had been scheduled for this past Wednesday. The trip was intended to deepen relations between the two states and included the next round of negotiations on a free trade agreement and liberalization of air traffic. Israel also launched out at others. It recalled ambassadors to Senegal and New Zealand, the countries that had sponsored the UN resolution. It canceled trips to countries which had voted for the resolution and loudly criticized the United States. A rabbi in Kyiv, Pinchas Vyshetsky, spoke to the Jerusalem Post about the situation. He said that he hoped relations would go back to normal, because at the base there is a true friendship between Ukraine and Israel, and certainly with Prime Minister Groysman. Groysman is Ukraine's first Jewish prime minister and has family in the Israeli city of Ashdod. 2016 could be called the year of decommunization in Ukraine. According to the Institute of National Memory, a record number of names and symbols of the communist past were removed from public places. New names appeared for over 50,000 streets. Almost 1,000 cities and towns got new names through public consultation. A record number of statues to Soviet-era heroes were removed, including 1,320 Lenin monuments. This happened in Eastern Europe in the early 1990s, just after communism had collapsed. In Ukraine, it started in 1991-92, but then slowed down and picked up again after the Euromaidan revolution. Although it's still a subject of debate, it's gaining more popular support.
In today's program, we're going to look at the state of journalism in Ukraine. I thought that today it would be very fitting to have with me, not for the purposes of an interview, but for a discussion, a fellow journalist, a very well-known journalist in Ukraine, a pioneer in his field, and now the director, or rather the head of the board of Hromadske Radio, of Ukrainian Public Radio, Andriy Kulikov, who, needs to remind you, was a very well-known TV presenter, journalist, interviewer, etc., etc. Anyway, a seasoned campaigner in the journalistic field and somebody that probably has his own thoughts and his own experience which he can share. I'm Bohdan Nahailo. I used to be a journalist in Britain, wrote a lot for the top British newspapers and journals like The Spectator and New Statesman, Times, whatever. But I presume that I'm better known here in Ukraine as the former director of the Ukrainian service of Radio Liberty in those critical years of 1989 to 91 when things were happening, as we say euphemistically. Anyway, Andriy, it's my pleasure to have you here in the studio. Tell me, what are your thoughts as we approach the end of this year? Positive, negative? What's your general feeling before we get into the substance?
Well, my general feeling is realistic, I would say. And harking back to what you said when you started this recording about taking stock and looking back, I also say we should look forward in no less degree than we look back. Because whatever happens next year is going to be no less important than the eventful year of 2016, which you mentioned.
Thanks for reminding me of that. Of course, it's the challenges that still lie ahead. But still, you know, I was trying to provoke you into telling me what your present mood is. Are we well equipped to face those challenges, or are we a bit hesitant? Are we a bit uncertain?
Depends also on what we have in mind when we say we, and how broad this we is. Do we say Ukrainians as a whole? Do we say Ukrainians who live in Ukraine and associate themselves with Ukraine? Do we say journalists in this country? Whatever. I think, but if we come to terms with this we, I say yes, we are. To the extent that every one of us, each and every one, understands what they should do.
You know, Andriy, I've been thinking a lot since I've been working here in my new capacity, heading an NGO called Democracy Reporting International. I used to work for the UN, now I'm working for that. I'm dealing a lot more directly with civil society, with students, with officials. And it's clear to me that this we today is somewhat different from the we that we knew 5, 10, 25 years ago. The we I refer to is a political nation in the making, crystallizing, particularly precipitated by the Maidan and the Revolution of Dignity. But also, I think this age of social media, where to be Ukrainian is no longer simply to live in Ukraine, to suffer in Ukraine, to be a prisoner and to be a dissident or whatever, a cultural activist, or just a decent Ukrainian, and the diaspora out there doing their thing, trying to preserve Ukrainian culture and to make the world aware of Ukraine's issues. I think today, where social media plays such an important role, where we are directly in touch with realities, this notion of we, they among Ukrainians, whether ethnic, whether geographical, whether diaspora, whether materik, whether, you know, being present here, is no longer as important, because we can listen to your radio station out there. We can see on TV what's happening on the Maidan as it happens and as people are getting killed. I remember we were standing in Geneva on that fateful day in February 2014, as demonstrators were being, as protesters were being shot down. We were demonstrating in front of the UN and we were listening to this horrible news. It was as if we were there with you. And so something has really changed. And that is a challenge for us journalists, too, to deal with that.
Definitely. But mind you, this had nothing to do with social media. You heard the news and you watched the news, I presume, from so-called traditional media.
No, I'm talking about Hromadske TV and the streaming that was possible. You know, people with cameras, with TVs,
streaming,
standing there.
Streaming is nothing new. You had direct broadcasts all those years back. And sometimes we invent new forms or new shapes and say that this is something new. You know, a movie shown on television is still a movie. Same as direct broadcast when it goes to the internet. It's still direct broadcast either from radio or from television. That's to say that we tend to exaggerate the meaning and the importance of social media. And sometimes when you say that, or you or other people say that they have brought about new reality, I think that they have brought about an imagined or invented reality. Reality is there. Reality is when I look you into the eye, when I know you as Bohdan Nahailo, the journalist from Britain or from Radio Liberty, but not as someone whose icon or whose avatar I see on the Facebook page. And really, for instance, for 7 years, there is a Facebook page which is supposedly done by myself. I have nothing to do with this.
No, but Andriy, what I'm getting at is this. Look, take my personal example. I was sitting in Geneva in those fateful days when the Maidan had just started. I don't know if we are to believe Mustafa Naim. It all started with Twitter and Facebook calls to come and protest against what had happened in Vilnius, the Yanukovych's about turn, about the association treaty. But then, when things hotted up and became brutally unpleasant and ugly, when human lives were at stake, when blood was being spilled, these young journalists were out there on the streets risking their lives and filming with their telephones, in effect, and streaming this not only into a central point in Kyiv and into Ukraine, but we living in the outside world could see this. That was something qualitatively different. I had, yes, the Orange Revolution had had elements of that, yes, but I'd never witnessed or experienced something where you were directly present on your screen. You were sitting in your kitchen for 16 hours glued to it because you felt you were part of it. Would this person live? Would that barricade still exist tomorrow? Would Yanukovych concede? Would he call another meeting? What would they say? What would the trio, you know, standing on the stage, what would they say? What would their response be? And it brought us, I think, qualitatively into a different type of mode of accepting and reacting to news and to coverage.
I still think that this is a just a new form of what was there for a long, long time. If you remember 1991, which you mentioned in the beginning, and dozens and hundreds of people going around Kyiv with their radio receivers glued to their ears, that was the same. If there were a portable television set, then they would do this. And sometimes I think that by exaltating or exaggerating the meaning of what has happened in Maidan in 2013-14, we tend to cross out what has been brewing in Ukraine for dozens of years. When I hear that the Ukrainian political nation was born on the Maidan in that fateful winter, I say that's entirely the opposite. Maidan was born and brought about by the Ukrainian political nation, which was being formed also due to broadcasts by Radio Liberty, the Voice of America, and other radio stations, although we should not exaggerate their influence as well. But the Ukrainian political nation was there in the 60s. It was there in the 50s.
Was it?
Yes. In a nascent,
I would argue, as a historian, that it really came about. Yes, individuals were involved. There were strata of society, maybe among the elite. But the regional and ethnic and religious fragmentation was there. I think that what helped glue us together was Ruch, its position in the late 80s, that it was not Ukraine for Ukrainians, but Ukraine for all the citizens on its territory.
Definitely, but it is still very many years before the Maidan.
Yes. Okay, look, let's not concentrate solely on that, because we still have quite a bit to cover. So let's look at these last 25 years. You started off as a journalist at that time. I was a journalist on the other side of the barricades, though I'm sure that we had it very much in common in our thinking. Maybe we could express it more openly than you. Don't know. But today, looking back at those 25 years, what do you see as the main achievements as a journalist, not political, not in terms of state building, but in the sphere of open media, open society, of us, you know, being accountable for news and its quality? Have we really moved a long way in those 25 years?
Again, who are we? Some of us have, some of us have not. And I think that the biggest achievement is that more and more people in Ukraine among our guild start to understand that the so-called freedom of speech or freedom of the press exists to the extent that you are able to take it for yourself. Some people would say, as for instance, Gorbachev used to think, I think, and well, he's done a lot, of course. But the gifts or presents from above, even if they are done in a good faith, do not make the climate, especially the political climate, yes? And you have to relive it. You have to live through. I remember when Gorbachev started his reforms, I was a member of the Communist Party, or was going to join the Communist Party. And I was a rather hardline communist, except for the ethnic and national independence issue. One-party system, yes. Planned economy, yes. Revealing foreign intrusion, yes. Although I must say I have never written a story which was against the so-called Ukrainian bourgeois nationalists. I have always been an adherent of Ukraine's independence. But at first I thought that he was not right. And this liberalization, which was launched in the Soviet Union, was not the way that we should go forward. It took me, I would say, at least 18 months to come to terms with what Gorbachev and the others were saying. So until you grasp it, until you are...
It's a matter of awareness and of your level of political culture,
yes,
and your openness to other possibilities, to the outside world. So as journalists, now that we've come together, journalists that were working for a similar cause from outside or inside, the we, I think, are those responsible those who feel themselves Ukrainian in the most positive sense of the word and in the most embracing sense of the word. What have been our achievements? Do we have a genuinely functioning free press and free media in Ukraine after 25 years?
I wouldn't say we have. I say that there have been some very bright splashes, very bright flares, starting with individual journalists like Sergei Naboka or Vadim Boyko or Alexander Krivenko, and, well, we easily can name several dozen of such people who are more or less known. There have been, or there had been probably, some very bright media which successfully functioned for some time, but then they were crushed by the oligarch or state pressure. We now work at Gromadsky Radio, public radio, which we think is a genuinely independent radio station, but there was Gromadsky Radio, public radio, in the first half of 2000s.
Andrei, but when was that moment when the promising start of the development of independent media, television, radio, when was this taken over, hijacked, bought by those with the wealth and who then manipulated things for their own political benefits?
I cannot name the precise date, but the mode was the same as with the two Ukrainian Maidans, or which are called revolutions. When people start to believe that those whom they brought to power will take care of them instead of them, then almost everything is lost. Same happened in the Ukrainian media sphere when journalists of, I would say, rank and file journalists and probably some media managers of medium level who have done a lot for the media independence and standards in the profession, saw that they have finally found owners who would abide by the principles and standards, but it turned out that no.
Well, we have two problems there, at least, because on the one hand, we have the rich, the wealthy, politically engaged in a narrow sense, in their, reflecting their own personal interests. They've taken over the commanding heights. Yeah. But on the other hand, those who had the wealth have also bought up a lot of the media estate of the market. And so you have this plethora, this mushrooming of TV stations, radio stations, hundreds and thousands of them.
I would not agree, Bohdan.
Tell me.
Yes. Radio, no.
Radio, no? I get the impression that there are so many radio stations.
Yeah, but how many of them are talk radios?
Music, yeah, and advertising. But you see, I think people then are lost. If you don't have the three or four or five, like, let's take, I'm from Britain. So, yes, we have independent radio stations, commercial radio stations. But essentially, in the old days, you listened to BBC 1, 2, 3, 4, same as Channel. So, you know, you wanted highbrow culture, you listened to BBC 2. You wanted this, BBC 1, something general. Here, I think people are lost. When you switch on the TV and you have 100 channels, what do you turn to if you want reliable information? This channel may be linked to the president. That one is linked to an oligarch. That one is linked to another oligarch. Who can you believe? How do you take your bearings, your moral, ethical, political bearings in such a noisy sea of so-called media?
You won't find an adversary in myself asking this question, because
I'm being provocative to get your response.
Well, my response is repeating your words. I've at least since I've worked in Britain for 8.5 years, I've been telling people here that the maximum and probably the feasible quantity, number of channels, television channels that we should have in this country should not exceed 7.
Makes
seven.
Sense. Magical number.
Five.
Yes.
Five. Very good. But that would be too British to have five. As far as radio is concerned, I think that Because radio is much more democratic and less pressurizing the audience, this is the reason why Ukrainian oligarchs or moguls or whatever the word is.
Tycoons.
Tycoons, tycoons do not want to invest it because it really leaves too much will and independence to the audience.
But, Andriy, today's Ukrainian audience, again, we can't say we, they, us, one would think that the lazy approach is just to put on the television and lie back on your sofa and watch whatever's given to you. How many people do you think, percentage-wise, still listen to radio and rely on radio, other than in cars, taxi drivers, etc.?
According to the latest figures I can quote, 28% of Ukrainian audiences constantly, regularly listen to radio, which is not bad because we have to keep in mind that those people who watch television often listen to television, and that's the potential for radio. Mm. One of the problems of the Ukrainian audience is that they've been rarely offered a quality product. And, of course, it is not enough to offer this quality product once or twice. You have to be persuasive and insistent in offering a quality product to people who are not used to quality so that they can taste it, so that they can understand why they really need this sort of quality.
Okay, I see our time is already beginning to run out. You see how time flies when you're having fun, as the English say, and having a good discussion. Okay, our audience and we are well aware that we live in the times of an intensified hybrid war, right? I don't think we need to go into that because I think people have thought through perhaps some of the issues involved. To what extent in conditions of war here do we have the semblance or the reality of censorship, be it reporting from the front or be it reporting via through the mere lack of transparency about political developments in the country and decision-making?
I think that if you're, so to say, media literate, then you can get all the information you need, but you have to put it through a sieve of your own perception, of your own experience.
You have to work at it a bit.
Yes, you have to work at it. There are, and there have been, and I think that there will be attempts on the part of authorities and of the military to gauge some of the media outlets. We've been witnesses to this. I can understand in some cases why the military do this. And sometimes, yes, I presume that a report from some frontline position may put at risk the lives of the military and so on and so forth. But as far as the state of the things in the army is concerned and the state of the relations between peaceful residents and the army is concerned, I think that 100% truth should be said. I'll quote just one small, really small example. A report from military authorities 2 years ago, when they said that they were supplying the Ukrainian army with everything they needed for the winter, and they said, "We have bought warm socks for the sum of," and then they quoted the sum. But no one knew how much one pair of socks costs and how many pairs of warm socks were bought and whether all the Ukrainian army was equipped with those warm socks or it went to a couple of regiments or brigades. So this is one of the problems. We sometimes are very complacent and we do not want to take another step or ask another question that would put these things into context.
In among your team, Hromadske Radio, let's take them as an example. Journalists that want to find the truth, that want to probe deeper, do they have access to more or less the truth, the objectivity that we seek, or is that lack of transparency also bolstered by buffers of an invisible sort?
One of the things is experience. Another thing is support from your bosses. or your managers, your editors. We always try to support our people who work in the field. Our people who work in the field sometimes do not very much ask for the support from the central office because their previous experience shows that not always the bosses are in one link with them, you know. To say we work to 100% capacity, I would say, no, we cannot say this. But to say we do as much as any other station and maybe more than them, yes, I can do this.
Before we finish with a few words about the challenges ahead, you personally, you had such a distinguished career as a journalist. You were a well-known personality on TV. You ran some of the best quality journalistic programs. What made you leave and come to radio and take the risks and face up to the challenges involved in heading Hromadske Radio?
The only word for this is radio. Radio, which has, as I again say, it is much more democratic than television. It can be and it should be a very broad ground for organizing public discussion in this country and involving as many people as possible in this. And at this very moment, during the war, radio has shown that it has not outlived its time, and in many cases it provides quicker and more reliable information than the internet or television.
And how do you cope? How do you survive materially, economically?
We rely on grants from foreign institutions, but we want to lower this dependence. Although I cannot remember a single time when we were dictated specifically what we should do. In broad terms, yes, of course, every grant has its conditions. But we also rely on support from our audience. We have conducted 3 successful crowdfunding campaigns in Ukraine and 1 mostly in the United States. And now we are trying to collect 3 million hryvnia for our further development. And we are probing at getting commercials.
How many of you are there? The team, how large is it?
By the last count, it was something like 70 people, but not only in Kyiv, also including our regional correspondents.
Andriy, let's look ahead now in 2 words or less. The challenges in bullet point form. What are the challenges for us as journalists in uncertain times, internationally, domestically?
Stay cool, talk clearly, think positive.
And remain ourselves. Retain our backbones. I thank you very much for this very stimulating, wide-ranging discussion. We've been listening to Andriy Kulikov, the head of the board of Hromadske Radio here in Ukraine, and I'm Bohdan Nahailo. Thanks for listening so much.
So for your year-end song, here's a piece called Civilization Clash. It's by a band from Lviv who call themselves Misty Gates.
Fire against the ice like legends. finished evil grows and spreading the disease. He's calling freedom as a slavery. We are for trees against the evil east. We're standing hard. It's great to be the warriors of life. You are so free as if you dare to be. Your patience ends and you stood up to fight. Betrayal fled from curse.
Next week, Ukraine Calling will be taking a break for Ukrainian Christmas. We'll be back with a new show for you on January the 13th, 2017. That's New Year's Eve on the old Julian calendar that's still observed by many people in Ukraine. Until then, from the entire Ukraine Calling team, Happy New Year! Yeni Yilin Kultu Olsen, that's in Crimean Tatar, apologies if I mispronounced it. S Novim Godom! Hanukkah Tova! S Novim Rokom!